It's December 1993. I'm sitting at the back of a primary school classroom in Rathfarnham in South County Dublin. The teacher leaves the room and has been gone a long time. We start to become unruly. As we brazenly leave our seats and abandon our copybooks and avoid a barrage of paper airplanes, the teacher reappears, but she's not alone. Most of the other teachers in the school troop in behind her. Our disruptive behaviour immediately ceases as we collectively slink back to our seats. Clearly something big has happened, and we are all potentially in serious trouble here. But the last teacher into the room has the TV trolley with her, the only television in the building, set up on wheels so that it's easily transportable from room to room, with an accompanying VCR so that the students can watch a David Attenborough documentary on the days when the teacher just cannot be arsed. None of the teachers comment on the fact that we were all clearly involved in a massive paper fight when they arrived in. Focus is much more on getting the misbehaving television back in line. After a prolonged period of muttering and remote control mashing, the static fuzz being displayed snaps to a picture of two old men sitting at a desk. Our teacher tells us we should be quiet, that something momentous is about to happen, and that we should all remember where we were when we witnessed what we were about to see. I think to myself that the other classes were so lucky that they were being left unsupervised. Why had the teachers chosen our classroom to show this boring footage? But there we sit in silence, as we view the Taoiseach, Albert Reynolds, and the Prime Minister, John Major, both sign what became known as the Downing Street Declaration. They both say words that I don't understand. When the formalities on the screen are over, the teacher follows that up with more words about how this signals an end to the troubles we've all heard so much about. The TV rolls back out the door, and the 10-minute interlude in my 9-year-old life has ended. More than 20 years later, and myself and my dad have driven up from Dublin and arrived in East Belfast for the start of the 2014 Giro d'Italia. No British Army on the border, nobody checking papers, no border at all actually. One of the biggest incidents in the peace process for years has occurred just this week. The president of Sinn Féin, Gerry Adams, was arrested and questioned about the 1972 murder of Jean McConville. But the incident passed, although the crime remains unsolved. Focus now turns to the relatively unimportant matter of the opening stage of the Giro, a 22-kilometre team time trial along the streets of Belfast. We made our way as close to the start line as possible and parked up at the Odyssey Arena. Throughout the drive into the centre of Belfast, you can't help but be struck by how much the Giro has taken over. Pink is everywhere. Outside shops, houses, churches, even on top of bus stops, there are tributes everywhere involving bicycles painted pink and dummies dressed up in pink cycling jerseys. We had a wander around the start village, which was a mix of bike porn and suggestions for cycling holidays. We decided against the idea of ordering pink coffees and settled for the regular kind instead. The team buses were all parked up beside the start ramp just in front of the spectacular Titanic building. The mechanics were setting up for the day, preparing all the time trial bikes and laying out the turbo trainers for the riders to warm up on before the race. An hour or so later, we began trudging up towards our vantage point for the day, which would be away from the city centre, somewhere along the New Tannards Road, just before Stormont, where we could see each team pass twice. The walk up the New Tannards Road revealed a curious mix of Giro tributes and street parties, interspersed amongst the famous murals depicting the political and religious divisions that had bisected the country. We stopped for a coffee once more halfway along the road, just inside the door of a small café, opposite a restaurant aptly named Il Pirata. 5 minutes later, there was the sound of car horns, followed by the deep, rumbling noise that can only be made by supreme athletes pushing massive gears which turn thousands of euros worth of disc wheels. With a whoosh, the first team practicing out on the route flew by the open door of the cafe as the wind they generated flew in and unsettled napkins on the tables. "Whoa, they were going fast," I said, as I leaped out the door to see who they were. The Colombians. We finished our coffees and continued on, eager to witness the other teams in motion, all of whom would probably be going faster than the Colombians. An anonymous wall, providing a view about a mile long down the New Tannards Road, was where we based ourselves. Sitting atop the wall provided the added bonus of a view into an unsuspecting resident's living room, where he was unwittingly providing us with free Eurosport coverage of the race as it unfolded. In case you're wondering where I get my nerdish, meticulous tendencies, my dad began the process of writing down the names of all the teams in the order they would come by, so we could stopwatch them as they went, timing how long it would take them from our spot up to Stormont and back. The weather was still fine as the first team came past. The Colombians again, this time for real, and even faster. They were quickly followed by Orica Greenedge. At those speeds, it's surely impossible to the naked eye to tell whether a team is travelling at 51 kilometres per hour or 52. But I swear, just from looking at them, you can tell the Australian team time trial specialists were obliterating the speed of the Colombians, who they were already beating, I can reliably declare, by 17 seconds. What a surreal moment, an Australian team chasing a Colombian team in an Italian race on the island of Ireland. And the sun was in the sky, it was actually sunny, I had taken my jacket off, what was going on? This wasn't the Ireland I knew, this wasn't the Ireland I grew up in. But bang on time, the clouds turned sinister and the heavens opened. Orica Greenedge were home and hosed, and nobody would come close to beating them now. They probably wouldn't have anyway. We sat there on the nondescript concrete wall getting pissed on, absolutely soaked. This was more like it. This was the Ireland I knew. The Ireland I love and the Ireland I hate. But there's beauty in that resentment. I've grown to cherish how much we are allowed to detest our own weather. But we'd miss it if it was gone. Or maybe we wouldn't. But my God, we'd complain about it either way. We watched team after team pass, keeping track of the split times. It was clear Orica Greenedge were going to win, and Nicholas Roach's team Tinkoff Saxo wouldn't be too far off. We decided to wait until Dan Martin's Garmin Sharp team had passed up and down, and then we'd start walking back to the finish line. But that was to be the end of our joyous occasion. We'd had enough fun, and we needed a bit of yin to balance our yang, apparently. We arrived at a pub window. The pub itself had been booked out for a private Giro party, full of important-looking people wearing important-looking suits. There's a television in the corner showing replays of the team time trial we've just witnessed. Our relationship has changed now, myself and that old television on wheels. We're both older and wiser, but there's still one of us that doesn't care much for what's going on. This time it's the television that doesn't give a shite. This time, I do care what's on the screen. I want heads to stop moving so I can see exactly what's happened. A crash. Riders are sprawled across the road. The camera fixates on a single rider, although it's hard to tell from this distance. I know who it is before the caption appears. During times of lawlessness and times of unrest, during times of peace and times of war, there is one law that remains constant and unbroken. One law that the world will adhere to forever and a day. Murphy's Law. One of the biggest bike races in the world comes to Ireland. There was one Irish rider in the race who can actually consider trying to win the thing overall. And on the first day, Murphy said, "Let there be crashing." And there was crashing. One crash, one rider, and it had to be Daniel Martin. The only one of the 198 that raced today who won't make it to stage two. Myself and my dad stand outside the window in the middle of East Belfast, an area particularly rife with the history that Albert Reynolds and John Major took steps to steer in a new direction that day in late 1993. We stood there taking the Lord's name in vain, repeated cries of Jesus and Christ of fucking mighty come out of our mouths as we watch another replay of that manhole that came out of nowhere, and we curse what might have been. Nobody cares about religion right now. The only religion right now is cycling. We engage in circular conversation where we conclude that it's only a bike race and it could have been worse. But then more what-ifs follow before we conclude once more that it is only a bike race. There are two things that Ireland excels at: shite weather and heartbreaking sporting moments. We trudge forlornly back to the finish line and back to the car, waiting for the trip back down to Dublin. But it's stopped raining now, although the mood remains damp. It is only a bike race though, isn't it?